What's up, Z-Pack? It's your boy Z-Dog MD, aka Dr. Zubin Damania, and I have an admission to make. I never believed in vaccine injury until I met Tom and Logan.
Autism.
You see what I did there? I insulted them by claiming they are vaccine injured, which is gonna get us so much hate on the best, on my favorite day of the year, guys. It's Labor Day. It's Labor Day, which means, this just in, Tom Heineber. in from Kensington Palace in the UK, in the heart of all that is good in the universe, the monarchy, the British Empire that the sun never shats on. Here it is. Kensington Palace, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge are expecting their third child. Their Royal Highnesses, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, are very pleased to announce that the Duchess of Cambridge is expecting their third child. The Queen and members of both families are delighted with the news, as is tradition. As with her previous two pregnancies, the Duchess is suffering from hyperemesis gravidarum. Her Royal Highness will no longer carry out her planned engagement at the Hornsey Road Children's Centre, in London today. The Duchess is being cared for at Kensington Palace.
Right out, Governor, you had it here first, eh?
With a little bit of luck, with a little bit of luck, then she won't need to get admitted. With a little bit, with a little bit.
Leah says, sorry, not sorry. She didn't have to get pregnant again. Yo, what's up? That's her job, to get pregnant.
Oh, no, you didn't. You did not just diss the Duchess of whatever, because, ha, two words, Pippa. Here's the thing, guys. So all joking aside, this is technically a holiday, so we're like, we just don't give an F today. But we're going to talk. We're going to do tribe teach today. And since it is Labor Day, and the Duchess announced her third pregnancy and her third coming down with hyperemesis gravidarum, which is a fancy way of saying puking your guts out in a major way during pregnancy, we thought, why not we teach about hyperemesis? Because you're gonna see on the news, ABC News, what is hyperemesis gravidarum? And then they'll turn to some guy, hi, I'm Dr. Picklesworth. I'm ABC's chief correspondent. Now, Tom, the thing about puking your guts out in pregnancy is it blows. Now, I'm a guy, so I have no idea, but I'm gonna talk about it like I know the woman parts.
You know, it's funny, a lot of people don't know that puking is uncomfortable.
It's terrifically uncomfortable for some, Tom. Back to you, Ed.
Well, you know, the thing about puking is,
why does he suddenly sound like a castrato?
Hey, Delia says, stop smoking that weed, Kate. I think we're on to you, girl.
Ooh, let's talk about that too. All right, guys, so what we're gonna talk about today, and I wish I could have given you guys continuing medical education or CEU or whatever it is that you like, but you're not gonna get it because it takes work and I don't get paid to do it. So, if you wanna donate to us on Patreon, maybe we'll think about giving you CE credits. But how about just learning for the sake of learning and having fun in the bargain? What did Bill Cosby say? I don't remember, but I don't care because he's a rapist. Let's go back to this. So what we want to talk about is this idea of pregnancy-related vomiting. When does it become what they call hyperemesis gravidarum? By the way, what does that mean, Tom? Do you know the Latin root for that?
Yeah, Tom.
I think it means...
Here comes the vaccine injury.
A lot of vomit. Something.
I don't know.
You're right.
So, come up with anything.
So Logan actually came pretty close. Hyper meaning a whole bunch or very fast or a lot. And emesis is the Latin for puke or something for puke. Gravid is a way of saying knocked up, so pregnant. Mm. And gravidarum is a way of denoting a singular pregnant woman. So hyperemesis gravidarum literally means puking a whole lot in a pregnant woman.
Is it unsafe to continue having children when you're at risk for hyperemesis gravidarum?
I think it's unsafe to continue having children at any point. I have two, there was no safety at all, and now my life is absolutely blissful. blissful people. You thought I was going to say something else. No, this is a great question, Tom, and I think we'll get to that because the recurrence rate for hyperemesis is actually quite high in future pregnancies, up to 20% or more. We'll have another episode of this. But what is it, first of all? Well, if you look at pregnancy in general, most pregnancies, 90%, have some association with nausea and or vomiting. And it's felt to be that there's a lot of theories for why people vomit in pregnancy, but one of the prevailing ones is human chorionic gonadotropin, gonads, HCG, which is a hormone that is released very rapidly in the first trimester and then comes down, is at least partially responsible for the nausea and vomiting of the first trimester of pregnancy in particular. And that's when the majority of pregnancy-related nausea and vomiting occurs. The feeling being that HCG levels are rising and it's that delta, it's that change in the levels that might be stimulating nausea. It could also be estrogen, but estrogen rises even higher later in pregnancy, but people statistically don't get more nauseous later. In fact, the majority of pregnancy-related nausea resolves around the 20th week of pregnancy, so right after the first trimester of pregnancy. In most people, not all, some people have a minority, like 5%, will be puking all through the pregnancy up till the very end. And if you're puking after, a few days after delivery still, people need to search for other causes for why you're vomiting. And in fact, you should always think about, are there any other reasons? And there are some warning signs. For example, if you're having nausea and vomiting early in pregnancy, but there's other things like you're, you know, vomiting up a lot of bile, you're having diarrhea or other lower GI symptoms, you have fevers or chills or significant abdominal pain, those are very worrisome symptoms, and it's not just a pregnancy-related uncomplicated nausea. Now, the thing is, when does it get so bad that you call it hyperemesis?
When you're not gaining weight during your pregnancy?
Oh, that's really close, man. So it's actually, that's exactly right. So nobody really has a strict definition, but the sort of kind of, a bunch of old guys sitting around a table, and it's always old guys, even though it's women parts we're talking about, because that's medicine for however many centuries. They usually say if you've lost 5% of your pre-pregnancy weight, during, you know, a bunch of, and you're having nausea and vomiting in pregnancy, they'll call that hyperemesis, or, you know, just it's just an extreme part of a spectrum that's already there of nausea and vomiting. And so 5% of the body weight, another sort of shorthand is if you have to be admitted to the hospital for IV fluids, if you're vomiting, you know, just constantly, if there's other complications, most likely you can call it hyperemesis because you're on the extreme of the spectrum. Mrs. Dog had horrible nausea and vomiting all through the first trimester, but almost as soon as the second trimester came by, everything resolved and she felt much, much better. And this happened.
Did she have that both children?
She had it worse in the first pregnancy, much worse. In the second pregnancy, it was quite a bit better. And some people report that, some people report the opposite, so on and so forth. So, any comments before we get into this?
You know, a lot of people are saying, like, I had it on my first kid, then it went away on the second kid, then it came back on the third kid. So, what is it that's causing it? Why can you, like, skip a pregnancy in the middle?
Let's talk about this. So, the epidemiology of it, see, nobody really knows what ultimately is causing it, but what they found is people who have problems and nausea with estrogen-related compounds like birth control pills, et cetera, have a higher risk of hyperemesis in pregnancy. And we'll to shorthand it now, we'll call it hyperemesis. So it's just severe vomiting in pregnancy, loss of greater than 5% of the body weight, getting admitted to the hospital, that kind of thing. So just so we define our terms. People who are motion sick, people who suffer migraines, they're more likely to experience pregnancy-related nausea and vomiting. And actually, super tasters, people who are able to taste certain compounds better than others, actually are at higher risk as well. And the thought is that they're more sensitive to tastes and odors and things like that, which can be a psychogenic trigger for nausea. Other things that can cause this are if you have multiple gestations. So you have twins or triplets or quintuplets or whatever. You know, John and Kate plus 8, you know what I'm saying? It's more HCG, so that's one theory for why that might be. And people with heartburn, you know, there are other risk factors. Now, there's also a thought that there's a genetic component to hyperemesis because sisters and mothers or people who have sisters and mothers that had hyperemesis are more likely to have hyperemesis in their pregnancy. And identical twins are more likely to share a hyperemesis predisposition than dizygotic twins or fraternal twins that don't share all the same genes. And that, again, says that there's some genetic component. Now, the thought is, you know, what's even causing it? And it's kind of, one interesting thing, I bet you didn't know this. So the predominance of people with hyperemesis end up having girls.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And actually, there's data. Let's see, what was the exact number?
So if my wife is puking a lot when we try,
it's a girl, Tom.
It's a girl.
Yep.
That's how you know.
I don't want to hear about
well,
you
no.
trying.
That's a complete misrepresentation of the science. But I like the way you think, Tom Heineberg, which is with your elephant.
Turns out I know science now. What's up?
So the odds, okay, if you have hyperemesis, the odds of having a female fetus are between 20 and 30% higher than
that's a lot, yeah.
So... The idea of what's causing it, we kind of talked about that. There's other theories, like there's some psychogenic factors. And there's some theory that like women who are actually averse to having the child and are worried about stuff are more likely to have hyperemesis as a sort of psychological overlay of that. But again, this hasn't been studied. People with H. pylori, Helicobacter pylori infections in their stomach, tend to have a higher rate of hyperemesis, and they don't know why that is. There is some evidence, let me see, about treating that. What did they say about that? There was an association, but there were case reports and tiny little series that reported improvement in symptoms in women with severe disease after they treated H. pylori, but they're just observational studies. So we don't really know. There has been a randomized control trial, so we don't know about H. pylori. All right, so that being said, you know, how are you even, gonna start to manage and score and to diagnose this? Well, it turns out there's a scoring system that goes by the name of Mother Risk PUQE scoring system, or PUKE. And I was gonna talk about it, and then I'm like, that's just dumb, okay?
Clever.
It's pretty easy just to figure, right? Real clever. Obstetricians, man, let me just tell you. So, that being said, how do you sort of diagnose it? Well, again, it's kind of a clinical diagnosis. Now, when a woman comes in vomiting and is not having trouble keeping stuff down and is clinically dehydrated, you need to do a series of tests to make sure that you're able to treat her in the correct way. One of them is simply blood pressure to make sure she doesn't have what they call orthostatic hypotension. So meaning the blood pressure is low when you go from a lying down position to a sitting up and then to a standing. And that's a sign of dehydration, not enough volume in the blood. When you stand up, the heart's trying to pump faster to get blood to the brain, but it can't keep up because there isn't enough fluid in the pipes. The other thing you should look for are other vital sign abnormalities, fever, things that might trigger a workup for another reason that she's having nausea and vomiting. But the other thing you got to look at are lab studies. So what's going on with her electrolytes? Because one of the first things to kind of go are blood electrolytes. Potassium, magnesium, phosphorus, calcium, which often rides along with magnesium because when magnesium is low, it makes you resistant to a hormone, PTH, that raises calcium levels, so calcium comes down with it. So we often will fix the magnesium first, recheck the calcium. If the calcium's good, then we don't do anything. If the calcium's still low, we can give calcium. Potassium's a very important one. Sodium can be low or high. If you're very dehydrated, the sodium can go up because you get concentrated. Sometimes you'll see, and this goes for any form of dehydration, you'll see the blood hemoglobin and hematocrit, in other words, the amount of blood mass, rise. Now, why would that be? Why would your blood count seem to go up if you're dehydrated, Tom?
Because gotta make more blood to make up for the water loss.
That's a great idea. And remember, Tom has no scientific or medical training. The reason it's wrong is that it takes several weeks to really regenerate new blood because it happens over a period of days to weeks.
I know. No, I used to do the Tour de France and I would blood dope. So
I knew you were a dope, but blood doping, man, that's pretty extreme. So maybe Tad knows the answer. It's something called hemoconcentration, Z-Dog. It means that when you take away the plasma component of the blood, the liquid component, when you measure the concentration of other things in the blood, they can go up because they're more concentrated because less water. So it, you know, it's simple as that, hemoconcentration. So you can see that happen. You can see, interestingly, in hyperemesis, and this is something I learned when I was researching this, abnormal liver enzymes. So you can actually see 2 to 3 times the normal levels of ALT and AST, which are liver enzymes. And it's when they've done liver biopsies on women who have hyperemesis, they've just seen non-specific changes, some steatosis, which is fatty liver, but they didn't see other signs of inflammation. And so, and they saw some bile plugs. So something's going on with the bile that or backup or something on the histologic level that I don't understand that is raising liver tests. Now, if they get to very high levels, you worry about other complications of pregnancy, but you can see this and it's actually not uncommon in women with hyperemesis. Other lab tests that you can find are your amylase and your lipase can sometimes be elevated. Now, we can see that in people who are vomiting normally, but you can see it in acute pancreatitis where the pancreas is inflamed. Lipase is largely specific to the pancreas, although there is some in other organs, but amylase can come from the salivary glands. So the thought is that women who are vomiting actually stress the salivary glands, and they actually, people with hyperemesis, they have hypersalivation a lot of the time, so they're producing a lot of saliva. So that might be one of the sources for that. It never gets to levels that you often will see in pancreatitis, so that's how you can differentiate. Plus, often these women aren't having epigastric pain, which often will come with pancreatitis. So that's how you can differentiate it from pancreatitis or something really life-threatening, you know, other than pregnancy, which will ruin your life.
Danae says, thank you so much for covering this topic. It's so hard to deal with something like this when people around you think it's just morning sickness and don't grasp how it literally puts your life completely on hold or don't understand why you would risk using drugs.
So what's a girl to do, Z?
What's a girl to do? See, and I gotta be honest, see, if a regular girl told me about this, I'd be like, psh, that's just morning sickness, girl. You need to just suck it up, all right? But when I heard the princess was in trouble, I was like, what can be done to stamp out this terrible disease?
It's very common that it takes a duchess to save the village. And the Duchess of Cambridge is actually, and this is actually a serious thing, she's shining light, and Logan had asked, like, well, what's a girl to do? And Tom's like, well, when do you not blow it off, right?
I was like, we need to save the princess.
We need to save the princess. Mm-hmm. You know, you're like Mario.
That's right.
You know, like every time I see Tom, I hear blank, 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 blank.
It's a me,
Tom.
Does that make me Luigi?
Dung, 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 dung. All right, enough video games. This is a serious thing because there is this idea that, oh, it's just morning sickness, it'll get better. But when it doesn't, when you're losing weight, when you're dehydrated, when you have signs of kidney failure, electrolyte abnormalities, coagulation abnormalities, vitamin deficiencies, which can actually not uncommonly happen because it only takes a couple weeks to deplete your body of certain fat-soluble vitamins, but also the B vitamins. And if you deplete yourself of thiamine, you put yourself at risk for Wernicke's encephalopathy, which alcoholics sometimes you see that with. It's more commonly seen there, but you can see it in pregnant women. And that will affect how you treat them. It will affect whether you could actually put their life at risk. So it's a very serious problem, and this is how you start to treat it. All right, let's go through that. Other comments
quick, before
we
get into it? What about Zofran? Is it okay?
Does it give you birth defects-y?
Yeah.
That's what these girls are saying. That's what they told my wife.
April is saying that pharmacists have scolded her before for it possibly causing cardiac defects, cleft lip slash palate. And is Zofran okay?
Okay, so, and I want to preface all of this because we're going to get into all that, but I'm going to cut to that piece now because I think that's a great question. I'm going to preface all of this by saying I'm not an obstetrician, I'm not a pharmacist, and this is not medical advice. This is infotainment. That being said, here's the deal with Zofran, as far as I can tell from my research. Now I sound like an anti-vaxxer. I did my research, Tom Heinberg, and drugs are bad, okay? Here's the deal. So Zofran, in some limited trials, has been associated with septal defects in the heart and some other abnormalities. Usually, and cleft palate. Now, usually when given in the first trimester when these structures are really starting to form, especially the palate, because the palate will close after the first trimester, and at that point you're usually out of the woods for some of those defects. Doesn't mean it's impossible, but usually.
Right.
So there is some thought that you don't give Zofran in the first trimester, but some people still do. And there are these pregnancy ratings for drugs, like A, B, C, D. Yeah, you know, and D is like, just don't give that shit. Mm. You know, C is like, well, there's some bad data and some good data, you know, roll the bones. But there's a lot of drugs in class C that we give fairly routinely, and maybe there's just not extensive data on it. A lot of these drugs haven't been studied. So Zofran is one of those that people are like, if you don't have to give it, because somebody's life isn't in danger. You know, they're not vomiting to death.
Right.
Don't give it, especially in the first trimester. But for many, it does work, and it is effective. But there are other options as well.
Yeah, we had a. They gave us a Diclegis.
What is that?
Diclegis.
Oh, Diclegis. Yeah. So we're gonna talk about that. Yeah, excellent, excellent. Look at this. Logan is like a poster child for hyperemesis.
My wife vomited a lot. It was gross.
Oh, I'm sorry. And my wife was a typical doctor. She refused to do anything for it. But this is kind of how it goes. So if you have just nausea, some women just have really bad nausea. But
yes, Mandy says, can you call her by her proper name? The Duchess of Cambridge. She stopped being Kate Middleton the day she got married.
She is the Duchess.
That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Refer to her as the Duchess. Yeah. Shut your mouth, peasant.
From now on, the royal puke shall be picked up. Where is the Duchess? No, she's just had a York peppermint patty because she's the Duchess of York. She's actually the Duchess of Cambridge, but you know, it's all good. I have mad respect for all the Middletons, especially my girl Pippa. Pippa, holla at a boy. Come on the show. Tad likes you. What were we talking about? Treatment.
Treatment.
So women who just have nausea, the recommendations are very simple. They're kind of start simple. One is dietary stuff. So one of the, and this is so poorly studied, it hurts, but one of the recommendations is small meals every hour or two, because a totally empty stomach or an overfull stomach are both triggers for nausea, particularly in pregnancy. So small, frequent, little meals. The second recommendation is don't drink, and this goes for across the board, don't drink a bunch of fluid with your meal because it fills the stomach. Have your fluid either a few minutes after or a few minutes before so that you're not jamming everything into your gizzards at one time, and that is the medical term. The other thing then, once you do that, is there's some thought that higher protein meals are actually better for hyperemesis and nausea and vomiting of pregnancy. So having a little more protein, low fat, and a bland diet, so nothing spicy, those kind of things, that's some of the conventional teaching. Now, whether any of this shit is actually solidly evidence-based, it's not clear in this. And I bet that it's not, because like any nutritional thing, it's just poorly understood. Yeah. So that's kind of the simplest first step recommendation. The second thing is, you know, again, avoid triggers. So if, you know, Tom Heineberg's body odor triggers you, Danielle, don't sniff his pits when you're pregnant. So try to avoid things that trigger. And they've done some studies. Women who are anosmic, and that's the fancy term for saying they're unable to smell, wouldn't that be an amazing wife?
Oh.
Because you could just fart.
Right now, this is how we cuddle in bed. I'm like, come here, babe. Come here. She's like.
Let's just say there's the Duchess of Cambridge and there's the Dutch oven. All right? So anosmia, being unable to smell, they often don't get hyperemesis, gravidarum. So kind of interesting, not always, but it's kind of interesting. So avoid the triggers, don't lay down after eating, different simple interventions like that. Now, as you start to escalate the interventions, you get to ginger. So there's some very soft evidence that ginger might be a little better than placebo for nausea symptoms. And that's kind of natural ginger lollipop.
Oh, so you just told pregnant women to eat sushi during their pregnancy? What's wrong with you?
Gotta stay away from ginger.
Stop that, Z-Dog MD.
I hate you so much, Tom Heineberg. You're trying to get us sued.
Sushi as a palate.
No, please don't eat a lot of sushi because the mercury. Ginger-containing foods, ginger lollipops, ginger tea, foods made with ginger root. It's a simple thing. Now, as you start to escalate, vitamin B6, pyridoxine, that has some data that says it might help. Nobody knows why, because a lot of times these women aren't necessarily deficient in vitamin B6, but it has some anti-nausea effect that may be better than placebo, and they give recommended doses in the literature and that sort of thing. But they sort of even looked at randomized controlled trials that show that B6 improves mild to moderate nausea, but doesn't significantly reduce vomiting. So you'll feel better, but you're still gonna hurl. So it might be better for people with just some mild nausea by itself. Now here's the thing, what Logan had mentioned his wife got was Diclegis. That's the next sort of step in the armamentarium. Diclegis is a fancy brand name for pyridoxine, which is that vitamin, plus doxylamine. Now doxylamine is an H1 antagonist, fancy way of saying an antihistamine, kind of similar to Benadryl, those kind of things. But it's more commonly known by its over-the-counter name, Unisom. Mm.
Unisom.
Yeah.
AKA Sleepy Pill.
Sleepy Pill. So Unisom with pyridoxine together in a combo, either together in a pill, which is going to cost you more, or separate, but taken together, has shown better results.
So expensive, see?
It's super expensive.
Oh,
Diclegis.
Unisom's expensive?
It's 200, no, the Diclegis is like $200 for 10 days.
And well, you know what's funny?
Insurance doesn't cover it.
It's of course it doesn't. And
a lot
here's
of people
the thing.
In the comments are saying, yeah, insurance doesn't cover
it. Kim Kardashian endorsed it and the price shot up when it first came out, which is when I had my kid.
Here's everything that's wrong with U.S. healthcare, right? They took two things that are cheap by themselves and they made a Reese's peanut butter cup out of them. So they're two great tastes that taste great together, but it costs a shit ton now.
It's time release.
And it's time release. That's but you can get extended release of each version of those separately. So in any event, I think, anyways. Don't quote me on that because I actually don't know. Our pharmacists, brothers and sisters, let us know if that's true. But you can take them separately if you can get that and take it together. Now, again, under a doctor's supervision, don't just go and do this, all right? So that being said, that's one other mechanism, the doxylamine, the pyridoxine. Now, here's a question. Immediately, you're going to get people going, oh my God, when I was pregnant, wait a minute, who am I looking
that
at?
That one.
Oh my God, when I was pregnant, I totally had one of those acupressure bands and it killed the nausea. And also my hand was asleep my entire pregnancy and I still can't feel my middle finger. Acupressure bands, there is some prelim evidence. There was some that maybe it helps, but now it's really felt to be a placebo along with acupuncture. Especially sham acupuncture, any kind of sense that you're getting needles stuck in you seems to help with nausea, but it's about as good as placebo. The thing is, placebo's pretty good. So there's no downside to an acupressure band if you wanna try it, if it makes you feel better. Just understand there's no magic or healing energy. And even when you understand that, the placebo effect will still work. So that's another way if you don't wanna get into the weeds of serious medication. Now, the thing is, hypnosis, you know, those kind of things, they might help psychotherapy in some patients where the pregnancy is a trigger for something, PTSD or depression or something. That can help in some cases, but those are sort of specific cases. Now, what are you gonna do? There's actually these complicated algorithms, which I encourage you to look up, but let me just go through the different therapies and kind of when they might be indicated. First of all, when you bring a woman into the hospital or the emergency department, you see her with this, you're an emergency nurse, you're a doctor, you're a nurse practitioner, the first thing you want to do is assess all the things we talked about. So make sure she's not, you know, what degree is she volume depleted? What degree do you need to fix the electrolytes? When you fix those electrolytes, by the way, don't give her glucose-containing IV fluid right off the bat. And hey, there's somebody walking behind us, that's creepy. The reason is, you can precipitate if she's been vomiting for a while, for a couple weeks, and she's vitamin B1 thiamine, if she's thiamine deficient. When you give glucose to someone who has thiamine deficiency, you can precipitate immediately and acutely a Wernicke's crisis, which can be very, very, very dangerous. So you always give the thiamine kind of first and maybe lactated ringers or some non-glucose containing fluid if the history is suggestive that this may have been going on for a long time. Then you give the thiamine, then you can give glucose in the fluid, D5, you know, half normal saline as a maintenance fluid. So again, I'm getting into the weeds here, but I want you to think about these things because sometimes you'll just see somebody reflexively order D5 normal saline and you can trigger a crisis in someone who's, you know, thiamine deficient. Were you gonna say something? No?
So what happens if like Diclegis doesn't work?
Right, so Diclegis doesn't work. This is where you start escalating. So you can try a different antihistamine. Diphenhydramine or Benadryl is another choice. And you can give 20 or 50 milligrams up to every, you know, 4 to 6 hours. Because Diclegis you do in these escalating doses, you start at night, then you add the morning, and then you do the afternoon. And it's a little trickier to dose that way, but the Benadryl you can give, you know, fairly routinely 4 to 6 hours. And you can give Benadryl IV, which can be nice if someone's hospitalized, right? Again, you know, the usual side effects of drowsiness and all that can come with that. And some people go nuts on Benadryl. They have these sort of paradoxical reactions where they go a little bit batty. I'm one of those. I hallucinated on Benadryl, which was pretty awesome, actually. It was the cheapest high I ever got.
You're a cheap date.
I'm incredibly cheap. Things like meclizine, diamine hydronate, those kind of, you know, antihistamine type agents can work as well. And they, you know, the data on the fetus is a little mixed on meclizine. So again, we don't go to first line agents with these. These are a little bit, you hold off on those. Now, other drugs like Reglan, metoclopramide, can work. It's also IV. The downside with Reglan is it can cause dyskinetic effects, in other words, movement problems, sometimes irreversibly, and it's more common in women. So again, we try to reserve that for further down the line because the potential maternal side effects can be there. Now again, I've given a shit ton of Reglan in my life, and I think I've seen one case of a movement problem from it that resolved when we stopped the drug. But then that I'm not a clinical trial. That's just my experience. So again, it's very specific to the practice of the individual doc who's treating it, but also you have to look at a bunch of different factors. So promethazine, which is Phenergan, is another option, and that can also be given IV. Prochlorperazine or Compazine is another one. So these are your standard sort of antiemetics, which is a fancy way of saying anti-nausea, anti-vomiting drugs, and you can give those. Now, when you start getting into kind of further down the line, like now these things have failed, and it's a problem because you're, at this point, you're not keeping down fluids, you're not gaining weight, you're losing weight. And this is a danger because the studies have kind of suggested that when women lose weight or they don't catch up that weight later in pregnancy, their children, the babies, are at higher risk for premature delivery and low birth weight, both problems.
Well, and then what happens, like, for instance, let's talk about the princess in particular. In her case, she's had, I think this is her third kid since 2013. Mm. So that's an awful tight window to have that many kids and to be dealing with this constantly throughout every pregnancy. Well, so what's the recovery time after dealing with the pregnancy with HG?
They surveyed women who had hyperemesis in their first pregnancy, and 37% of them said they would not have a child again.
Yeah, some of the people in the comments are saying that like one was enough, like it sucked, and I'm not doing it again.
It was such a horrible experience for them that they said that's enough. And I've met a lot of women like that who had horrible pregnancies like that, and they're like, that's enough. You know, I had my child. There isn't data on that. So the thing is, if you catch up your weight at some point in pregnancy, it's safer for the baby, safer for the mother. If you don't, then that's a problem. Now, if you keep doing that, is it additive? Nobody really knows what the toll is. I'm trying to remember what the evidence was. There's some protective effect on cancer for women who've had hyperemesis.
Oh, really?
And it's an association. So women who had hyperemesis in pregnancy have a slightly lower risk of certain cancers. And you can speculate a million times, what's the association? Is it even related? Is it correlation, not causality? One speculation is that they lower their levels of insulin because they're so malnourished during pregnancy that insulin can promote certain tumors because it's kind of has a growth effect. So there's a lot of interesting stuff.
That would be slightly related to, they say that calorie restriction has an effect on cancer.
Same thing. So calorie restriction may occur through multiple components because metabolites from burning calories have free radicals and oxidation and can cause cellular damage, but also the lowering of insulin levels.
Right.
So it's interesting. So
if you were the princess's doctor, though, would you be, if you were her OB, would you be recommending, or would you be like, listen, you need to take a break between kids? Like, I know there's pressure to have the next royal baby, blah, blah, blah. It's going to be on the cover of People magazine, but take a break. Take a break, girl.
Man, I would have been like, if I could have been your doctor, I would get with your friends. I wouldn't say that. But I do love the Spice Girls. No, this is what I would have told her. She's taken a year or two off. I mean, a couple of years between kids, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of tough to, I mean, I think that's plenty of recovery time. It's a question of how sick was she? We don't know. She was treated at the NHS. How sick was she during those other pregnancies? If it was really, really bad, you might counsel, hey, you know, it's like having a pre-existing chronic disease like lupus or something like that. You get a high-risk pregnancy. Now, some pregnancies are more high-risk than others, and this is actually not the highest risk in the risky pregnancy sort of category. So it'd be tough. And again, I'm not an obstetrician, and I don't play one on TV, but I think, you know, I might advise, okay, if you tolerated it last time and you're okay with it psychologically, then we can go for it. But you're right. there's a lot of pressure to put out these babies.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, this is, you know.
They're the first Stuart babies since Queen Victoria.
Is that right?
It is.
Wow. So yeah, does she inherit some kind of feudal estate?
If all the other people die and one of them takes, they bring back the Stuart name.
Aye, there can be only one Stuart, lass. And that's you.
Let's see. Rachel says, it took me 9 years to have baby number two. Went through HG again, never again. So, like, maybe it was just 9 years was enough time for Rachel to forget how terrible it was. And then she was like, I'm ready to go again.
Many women, my wife included, said they'd forgotten how bad the pregnancy was the first time. And they were like, let's do it again.
Right.
And actually, the second wasn't as bad, especially the delivery. The delivery was much easier. But that's not uncommon. So when you get into those, like, you know, quaternary level drugs here, like the serotonin antagonist. And then we're talking about Zofran, which is the brand name for ondansetron. You know, again, we kind of talked about it. It's an unlabeled indication, hyperemesis, to use it. And I'm going to read some of this verbatim because I think it's important. In a small randomized trial, use of ondansetron, onblixin, it sounds like a reindeer, resulted in clinically significant reductions in both nausea and vomiting compared with a combination of doxylamine and pyridoxine, or diclegis. So it's better, maybe. And it says, where am I in this?
By the way, Diclegis totally sounds like an NFL player. Diclegis Jones, the hardest hitting free safety in the league. They told him he was too small to play the position. He didn't listen to
him. He sounds to me like some kind of Dungeons and Dragons villain.
Diclegis.
Lord Diclegis, bring on Dansatron to me. Princess Losartan will be mine. So the authors of this basically say that it's controversial. They individualize its use, weighing the risks and benefits during pregnancy. We counsel pregnant women regarding the available data and possible associated small risk of cardiovascular anomalies. We talked about that earlier. There are no human data on the safety of the other drugs in that class, like granisetron and dolacetron, which are the brothers of ondansetron. Diclegis, bring me my ale. And
Diclegis Jones up the 40 to the 50 to the 60, he's gonna make the tackle.
That's so stupid. I don't know why I find that so funny. Oh my God. Anyway, so available data suggests that use of ondansetron in early pregnancy is not associated with a high risk of congenital malformations, but a small increased risk of cardiovascular malformations, especially septum defects, may exist. A 2016 systematic review including the following studies and two smaller studies came to the same conclusion. Animal data are reassuring as to its safety in pregnancy. So there's a Danish study, there's some other studies. So again, the jury's kind of out and people weigh the risks and the benefits of it. And this is, look guys, like, this is actually important. So much of medicine is this. Maybe it'll cause your heart to explode. Or maybe it'll save your life.
Right.
We don't have enough data, we don't have good quality data, and we don't know. So now we have to use this thing called clinical intuition, which these days is in short, and experience, which is in short supply, because motherfuckers just click in boxes.
Right.
And we're gonna talk to Robbie Pearl about health IT and other things, like improving medicine through data. But what happens when you're in a gray area? Watson doesn't know the answer. AI doesn't know the answer. The person who is going to be the best partner with you is somebody who's formed an alliance with you to sit and weigh the risks and benefits, has the time to talk about them and go, you know what, you're puking your guts out. This thing has this tiny risk. We don't really understand it, but I've seen it work in a lot of patients without any problems. Do you want to try it? If it were me over there in the bed, I might try it. Sometimes people need that.
But if we're all just guessing and it's a gray area and I have Google at my disposal, well, why should I listen to your intuition? I should listen to my mommy instinct. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
I know better than you do.
Yeah, but when you form a deep relationship with me and my team and my staff, you are going to trust us and our experience, because you're going to ask us, well, have you seen this before? Do you see this? Now, a lot of times we're wrong. But the thing is, in these kind of situations, we just don't know.
Right.
Now, contrast that, Tom, to, say, managing sepsis or something. There are certain protocols. You want to recognize it early. There's protocols that go into place. Those can save lives. And there are a lot of docs who are like, well, my intuition isn't buzzing about this woman with a UTI who has some of these warning signs, like a slightly elevated lactate or whatever. I'm not going to do anything. And then she dies of sepsis.
Right.
Because in those cases, the protocol is known and cookbook medicine could have saved her life. So it's these gray areas where Health 3.0 actually shines, because we are technology enabled, we're evidence empowered, but we're never enslaved to the check blocks as we get to use our brains because we have time to spend with our patients and we're paid on outcomes that matter.
Right.
So anyways, that's a tangent, but an important one. So those are kind of the, when you fail all that, they drop the atom bomb on you. And we all know what the atom bomb in medicine every single dime is. It's steroids, bitch.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else fails, just give them glucocorticoids. And there is very little evidence that these help, but people will use them. The biggest side effect really is maternal side effects from steroids. So, you know, all the fluid retention and craziness and other stuff that can happen with steroids. For the baby, it's relatively safe. There's some thought about fetal adrenal suppression and other things. But overall, in a pinch, they'll do a course of steroids if everything else fails. And I suspect, I wonder if the Duchess of Cambridge got steroids at some point during her pregnancies, because I remember reading that it was pretty serious.
You think the Duchess of Cambridge goes through socialized medicine?
Yeah, I bet she does.
Like the commoners?
I think she does, actually. I actually think she does. Because, correct me, guys, in Great Britain, did she go to the NHS? Did she get the typical care? Or was it a two-tiered system? Was something else going on? Yeah, I'd like to know. And by the way, we're going to talk about this probably on Wednesday, but this idea of the socialized medicine versus American medicine, it's really a perspective and a framing. If you ask people in Europe, they're in an environment where they are really happy to have access to care when they, you know, when it really is serious, and they're willing to sacrifice standing in line for routine stuff and delays and things like that. In America, it's opposite. We want individual choice. We want to be able to go when we want, but we're willing to sacrifice worse maternal outcomes, worse infant mortality, worst outcomes in the developed world to get that independence. So much of it is how it's societally, culturally, and politically framed.
That's right. We ain't trying to be ruled by no king.
I can't hear you over my freedom, Z.
A message from the king. A message from the king. You'll be back. Okay, so back to the last piece of this. As we hemorrhage viewers because we're on tangents that no one can ever follow us. If all of this fails, you want to look at other things like acid-reducing agents, you know, Pepcid, cimetidine, those kind of things. In some women, they have so much reflux because in pregnancy, the lower esophageal sphincter that keeps stuff from coming back up relaxes, and some people find that reflux can trigger nausea, vomiting. So you can try those kind of things. And acids that contain calcium and aluminum, like Tums, Mylanta, those can be options for women. But talk to your obstetrician. Don't listen to me because this isn't medical advice. And then, of course, vitamin repletion, all those other things. When it gets really serious, they go to like things like droperidol, clopromazine. That's Thorazine, people. Like if you have to take Thorazine and droperidol, which have serious, serious side effects and complications, you are very sick. Now, when do you start tube feeds on someone who has hyperemesis or total parenteral nutrition where you're giving feedings through a vein?
I know this. Moment of conception.
That's how you get them.
So it's like, I'm sorry, man.
You know
you
what?
Get in there early.
If life begins at the moment of conception, then tube feeding should start at the moment of conception. Oh my God, dude. Oh my God, Z-Pak. I just thought of the best name for a pastry bakery in the history.
Moment of confection.
Moment of confection. Oh my God. And you could set it up to look like an abortion clinic.
Okay, now you lost me.
It got real all of a sudden.
Now you lost me.
It got real all of a sudden. Moment of confection. That's amazing. Anyways. So when do you give tube feeds? And you're talking about putting in a tube through the nose, into the jejunum or the gastric area and bypassing the stomach. There is decreased motility in pregnancy, and that's part of the reason people get nauseous as well. So this is clinical judgment. If people are unable to hold down solids, they're starting to lose a lot of weight, their electrolytes are consistently deranged, they're in the hospital, then you may want to start that. Because again, getting nutrition in during pregnancy will be paramount. So And you want to start feeding as soon as you can, at least orally. And if you can't do that, then you really have to start thinking about that. Now, one of the key things is you taper these drugs off and these interventions off as soon as you can if the vomiting is stopping. So really try to get people off. The minimum viable drug exposure is always the best in pregnancy. And in life, in general, it's the best thing to do. Now, in terms of long-term outcomes, follow-up data of children with of moms who had hyperemesis is fairly limited. It has been associated with some degree of reduced insulin sensitivity in prepubertal children. Nobody really knows why, so they're less sensitive to insulin. And again, this is just an association. It's not a causative thing. Nobody really has a clue what the long-term complications are, but they don't seem to be obvious. So, that being said, that's kind of hyperemesis gravidarum in a nutshell. I would advocate, if you're looking to get pregnant, you've had it before, you're currently pregnant, suffering from it, talk to Tom Heinemann.
Tom's available.
That's right, he's not available. But talk to your obstetrician, talk to your primary care doc, your family doc, your internist about this, and powwow with them in a 3.0 way and figure out the best solution for you. What do you think?
Yeah, Tom.
I just gotta say, Prince William didn't do it right, if you ask me. If I was him, I would have married Kate and Ashley.
Wow, dude. You took Kanye to the next level. You know what I'm saying? Dun 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 dun. You know, did you ever
What's drugs, my Dilla? What's that jacket, Margilla? Doctors say I'm the illest, cause I'm suffering from realness. Got my N-words in Paris, and we going gorillas, huh? I don't even know what that means. Nobody knows what it means, but it's provocative.
But it's provocative. I've been wanting to do a parody of that forever. Somebody already did it called In Clinic, but I wanted to do like In Pharmacy or something, you know? What, these pills I'm dealing? Anyways, let's read some comments, actually. I want to read a few comments because comments are dope.
Lindsay says, I was put on Zofran for 7 weeks, was on Pick Zofran until 8 months, then was able to switch to oral. So glad I'm never doing that again.
Wow, so understand what she's saying. Peripherally inserted central catheter, PICC, P-I-C-C. She had this special central line to give her Zofran because it was that bad. It's horrible, guys. Like, listen, I'm a guy and I throw a fit. It's like man flu for me. If I get sick and nauseous and have to puke, it's the end of the motherfucking world. So women who have to do this, like when my wife was puking every single day in first trimester, I was like, this is unimaginable horror. But I just stopped imagining it because I would have been just incapacitated with unhappiness. So I just blocked it all out. All her screams and vomiting. I was like, I don't hear it though. I don't hear it. Tad hears it though. Tad hears it. That's why. Rock hard, you know why? I work out my anger. I work it out. Other comments?
Michelle says, cool, if you can just go over some more OB stuff, that'd be great because I'm taking the NCLEX tomorrow.
Oh, sure, man. The notorious OB. Did I ever tell you guys about my OB rotation? It was the horror of my life. It was my first third year rotation in medical school, San Francisco General Hospital at the height of the HIV epidemic in the mid 90s. And I wanted to die. Those OB docs were so mean to me, both the women and the men. They were mean. But I learned a lot. I learned a lot, and the patients were, wow. I mean, they were high-risk pregnancies. We diagnosed one woman with a normal endometrial biopsy. She was having abnormal bleeding. And then the pathologist called up 2 days later and was like, actually, we got that wrong. She has endometrial cancer. And this was my patient. And I'm a third-year medical student. I'm 20, how old was I? 24. Six or something.
Yeah.
And I had to, they made me tell this patient that we got the diagnosis wrong. We cleared her inappropriately. She was celebrating too soon and she has cancer. And the resident was standing there with me.
Was it bad?
Like a dumbass.
Was bad cancer?
Well, it seemed to be pretty confined, so she was probably going to be cured. But patients don't know that.
Yeah, cancer's cancer.
And we don't know that. Cancer's cancer.
And, you're like, ugh.
And I remember, she was, and what was interesting is, you know, and again, this was San Francisco. She was a lesbian. Her partner was there. They'd been together for like 30 years. And the partner bursts into tears, and they're hugging and crying, and they're hugging me. And I'm like, I don't know how to handle this.
Yeah.
Like, and I still to this day, I wake up like in a cold sweat from that rotation, because that was my first sort of exposure to the real world of medicine. And it was horrifying. that's how you learn, right?
That's literally like learning to swim in the deep end.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And part of the problem was I was a lazy medical student. So like I would ditch class, study the night before. So I really wasn't in the game. And then suddenly I'm in the clinic and I'm like, this is real. And I caught up pretty fast, don't believe that, because it was scary. Other comments, other thoughts?
Let's see. Socialized medicine countries do well in getting same day and next day primary care appointments. Okay.
No, and that can be true. Where it becomes difficult is if you're trying to do more complex stuff, like in Canada, getting a hip replacement, a knee replacement can take time. Now, here's the question. Do people really need those replacements, especially the knees or knee arthroscopy, say? You know, there's a lot of data that sham surgery is just as good as the real surgery. So are we even getting it right? But again, that's a whole nother conversation. There's always trade-offs in every system, and we're going to talk a little more about that.
Plus, I would ask you, do those countries have stock market?
Nope.
NASCAR?
Nope.
NASA? Hydrogen bomb?
Space?
Internet? No.
America?
America.
None or some of the above. America. On that note, guys, thank you for joining another Tribe Teach. If you like this concept, let us know. Hit like, hit share. Share this with people you think would benefit from the learning. If you can help us out on patreon.com/ZDogMD, people have been donating lately in force, and it helps us so much to pay for all this and bring this wonderful comment right to you. Well, Gavnet, looks like... Now I mixed an Australian with an Indian with a Scottish accent there. That was a disaster.
It was bad.
The Duchess of Cambridge is now hopefully going to be well. We wish her well and her family well, and hopefully for a safe delivery with minimal vomitus, because vomitus is so uncomfortable. And we want to thank Z-Dog for all that he does. And Tom Heinuber, Logan Stewart of the Clan Stewart, thank you. And we out.
I'm drafting my fantasy tonight. Declegius Jones! First round, baby! Woo! Yeah! Hardest hitting free safety in the league, Declegius Jones. Touchdown.
Princess Losartan to my side.
My mean! Bring it!
Go, 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 go.
They told him he was too small. They told him he'd never play in the show. But he's showing everybody who's wrong. Declegius Jones.
Declegius Jones.
Clear.